The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Let's go ahead and get started. I think we're about on time here. I think people do move a little bit slower on the last day of a conference. Welcome to Beyond the Notes, Music as Arithmetic, Geometry, and Cosmology. I tried to find a title that might be intriguing, so we'll hopefully enjoy this walk through this. My name is Gregory Wilbur. I live in Franklin, Tennessee. I am chief musician and work in worship and discipleship at Cornerstone Presbyterian Church, as well as serving as interim dean of New College Franklin. And some of what we'll be talking about today is essentially a view of the quadrivium from the perspective of music and seeing how some of those things kind of go together. Of past conferences over the years, I've spoken on the idea of the place of music in the curriculum, arguing very vehemently, I think, at times, for the role in which it needs to play K through 12 as an integrated part of the curriculum. So we've dealt with kind of that part of the issue, but today I want to talk more about the why, some of the background aspects, the philosophical connections, and the way that it interrelates to the other subject matter, as to how that can interplay then with the rest of the curriculum. But before we begin, let's open with prayer. Father, we do indeed thank you for the world that you have made, the way in which things are held together by the word of your power. By the way in which the things that you have made reflect your glory and help us to understand even more who you are. Father, I pray that you would use this time in our hearts, in our lives, you would use it in our classrooms. You would use it in conversation with students, with parents, to help us understand even more fully who you are, the beauty of what you have made, and how we may more fully glorify you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Plotinus, the Roman philosopher, wrote once that all things are full of signs, and it is a wise man who can learn about one thing from another. We'll take that a bit as our roadmap through this discussion today. Essentially, then, what is music? Sound organized in time. Strictly speaking, music is sound organized in time. This definition implies several important distinctions. Music is an activity of subcreation that requires intent. When my daughter was a preschooler and she came home from a music class and slammed the door on the cupboard saying that was music, I took exception to that. She couldn't quite understand why. She was three at the time, but I did. So it requires intent. I guess that didn't require some intent on her part, but we talked about the difference between that and the fact also that music is not random or chaotic. It's an organizing factor there. The organization of music complies with inherent principles of created order. We'll talk a little bit more about that, what that looks like. Music structures time. Music develops over time with a beginning and an end. That's part of the structuring of time. It has a starting point, and it continues then until an ending point, despite the fact that most modern music has a fade out. That doesn't really count. That's not that's stopping a piece of music as opposed to ending a piece of music. Two completely different things. If you've ever tried to, in a choral setting, to fade out, it doesn't really work. A Holst, I guess, in The Planets does that because the choir just leaves. They just walk away. Music moves through time to a place of completion. Music constantly refers to itself in the past, the present, and the future. You may not know what is significant about a piece of music because you don't know what's going to be developed later on. But in retrospect, then, seeing how that theme was developed in a certain way becomes important. Music, therefore, is a way of adorning time. Now, this is different than other art forms. Some of you may have gone to the Vermeer exhibit while you've been here in Atlanta. There's a difference between standing in front of a painting, in which you can see all of it at one time. You can concentrate on various aspects, but to see it all at once, you can comprehend that in that way. Music, you cannot, because it takes place over time. And so, which is one of the reasons why repeated listening is important. A score is important as well. But to be able to refer back to what has happened before and to see how that gets developed and to see how the composer then does something with that over the period of time. It's an oral art. But interestingly, music also takes up space. I mean, just for the sake of physics, there are sound waves that are moving. Even now as I speak to the room, it's filling this space. Jeremy Begbie speaks about this as a very interesting explanation of the Trinity. Some of you may have heard him talk about this or read about this. You know, all of our visual representations of the Trinity fail somehow theologically. There's some sort of heresy that creeps in a visual representation. But when you talk about music, if you play a note, the sound of that note fills the space. If you play two notes, both of those notes still fill the same amount of space, but they're interrelated one to another. You play a third note, there's a connecting point between all three of those. They still are three notes, but still in one connecting point in one space. And part of that connecting aspect of that, the ratios and the proportions inherent in how those notes are related to one another, is part of our subject matter. One of the Greek commentators on Pythagoras said that the Pythagoreans considered all mathematical science to be divided into four parts. One half they marked off as concerned with quantity, the other half with magnitude, and each of these they posited as twofold. A quantity may be considered in regard to its character by itself or in relation to another quantity. Magnitudes is either stationary or in motion. Arithmetic, then, studies quantities as such. Music, the relations between quantities. Geometry, magnitude at rest, and spherics or astronomy, magnitude inherently moving. So we have number in relationship one to another, the ratio of proportion. Pythagoras is often credited as the father of all sorts of things, but music being one of them, and there's this wonderful story about Pythagoras, which can't be true, but you know, who cares? Walking down the street one day, he hears these harmonious sounds coming out of the blacksmith's shop, and discovers that the size of the hammer and the anvils is creating a certain pleasing sound. And so he measures those and determines that the simpler the ratio, the more harmonious or the more pleasing the sound is. And from that then develops the whole idea of the ratio that forms the octave and then forms the fifth and the fourth, etc. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the point is that the of course, he was, as a mathematician, the aspect of the number and then the harmonious aspect of that, that the simpler the number, one-to-one ratio is a unison. You can't get more unified than that. It's the same note. 2-to-1 is an octave. If you take a string and pluck it and then put your finger in the middle and pluck it again, you have an octave higher. And so it's essentially the same note, only higher or lower. And then with 3-to-2 and 4-to-3, you wind up with the fifth and the fourth. And those are the most common and the basic building blocks then of Western music. You've got the quote there in your notes, Henry Chadwick and Boethius, one of the most important philosophers in writing about music and setting forth the idea of the music of the spheres in the medieval period. The theory of music is a penetration to the very heart of Providence's ordering of things. It is not a matter of cheerful entertainment or superficial consolation for sad moods, but a central clue to the interpretation of the hidden harmony of God in nature, in which the only discordant element is evil in the heart of man. Augustine said at one point, too, the only notes that are ours are the wrong ones. You know, I remind myself of that a lot on Sunday mornings. The shift of musical education out of the core curriculum at the time of the Enlightenment hinged then on what man believed about the cosmos. As man thought differently about the created world around them, it made a difference then in what they taught and how they taught, and specifically in regard to the content of music in the curriculum. If there is a creator God, this would be the reasoning how this would go, if there is a creator God who made the world with a pattern and order that is manifested throughout all creation, if all things interconnect at the point of their origin in one God, if there are absolutes and objective standards for the arts, then it is the role of the artist to discern, study, and utilize the patterns and order of the cosmos with a desire to emulate the created order for the purpose of both thinking God's thoughts after him and of gaining wisdom and understanding as to the nature and character of God. If, however, man's reason is the ultimate guide for understanding and truth, man himself becomes the arbiter and the standard for the arts, and the ultimate goal becomes entertainment and pleasure rather than godly wisdom. That's a significant shift, then, in why one would study music. It's a significant shift in how music was utilized. The difference between music and service to the church, the difference between the idea of music elevating your thoughts, organizing your mind, reflecting the created order. In some instances, and some of the philosophers actually suggesting that the best types of music not only reflect but also contribute to the order then of creation. That's a far different reason for study of music than that we like something or that it's an entertainment. And that's basically the heritage that we have as to why we study music. And a lot of that shift came too, and then with the aspect of music being written specifically then for the concert stage. This venue of coming and passively listening as opposed to either active participation or the idea of it being in service to the church or to another type of venue. The idea of the number then, the idea of dimensions, how this relates to music. Wisdom of Solomon says, "Thou hast ordered all things in measure, in number, and weight." And Paul says in Ephesians 3, "So that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God." Let's do a quick little math lesson here. So if you have a point, and I should still be on here, if you have a point, you have zero dimensions. You know, Euclid's definition of a point is that which has no part. There is no length or height or breadth. It's zero dimensions. The way in which this would be represented with the idea with the Greeks would be that. That would be the monad, the idea of one or oneness. When you add a second point, then, and connect those two points, you then have a single dimension. You're moving from one to the other. As Euclid says, a line is breathless length. So you have length there, but there is no height or breadth. You have a line, you have length, you have one dimension. If you add a third point, and then connect these two, which this is incidentally Euclid's first proposition in Book 1 of the Elements, drawing of an equilateral triangle. We know this is equilateral because the radius is always equal in a circle, and so this is a shared radius between these two circles, and so therefore this radius here would be the same as this, this is the same as this, this is the same as this, and so all three sides then form an equilateral triangle. So with the addition of the third point, you then have the opportunity for two dimensions. You've added length and height, but there still is no depth. But you see then the representation of how we move from one point to 2 points to 3 points, moving from zero to one to two dimensions. An interesting thing here too, I mean, I'm showing you these in the traditional Greek form. What is the, with an Arabic numeral, what is the implication or the symbolic understanding of three? As written as like this. Well, it's just, but we're, in terms of how you see this, how you see this line on the board here. Kind of in a row, depends on how I write it, you know. I could be really messy. But the other way that you would express this, more along the lines of Pip's, if you have those three points, you see in this system of understanding numbers, theology of arithmetic, one of the early texts, you see the interconnectedness then of the building up of 1 point to 2 points to 3 points. You see the fact that each one of these points is connected to the other 2 points. This one's connected to these two, this is connected to these two, etc. So each point has a relationship with the other 2 points. And so the idea of threeness is one in which it has a cohesive whole, in which all three of those points are interrelated to one to another. How this works out, too, symbolically, and interestingly enough, this is also consistent with the way that Scripture uses uses number symbolism. With the monad, symbolic idea of that is stability. It's known as the first. It's known as essence, the builder, the foundation, unity. The dyad, two-ness, otherness, polarity, separateness. The triad, prudence, wisdom, piety, friendship, peace, harmony, relationship. And as we build up numbers with the idea of the constituent parts, we're not just looking at three in isolation. What we're seeing is one and two, and together that makes three. And so we see how each one of those parts then make the whole, interestingly enough. And then with one, two, and three, if you add those together, you get six. If you multiply them together, you get six. It's the only number that does that works for. So therefore, six then became a significant number as well. And as I said before, this was part of Euclid's concept then in his teaching of geometry, understanding those aspects of number. As Pythagoras said, there is geometry in the humming of the strings, there is music in the spacing of the spheres. And so we've done one point is zero dimension, 2 points is one dimension, 3 points as two dimensions. If you add a fourth point, that enables you to, I know it's small, sorry. You move into the realm of three dimensions with a tetrahedron, the first of the Platonic solids. And so now we've moved into the opportunity to have that third dimension. Now, the fun thing about Platonic solids, I love the Platonic solids. There's all sorts of fascinating things about them. Tetrahedron has four sides, is made up of 4 points, 4 triangles. This represents fire in terms of the 4 elements. The octahedron, which has 8 sides, represents then air. The icosahedron with 28 triangles represents water. The hexahedron, the cube, 6 squares, represents earth. And the dodecahedron with 12 pentagons is the quintessence. And so you have the 4 elements and the quintessence, the 5 platonic solids, the basic shapes. But built off of, you know, a triangle of 3 sides, squares of 4 sides, pentagons of 5 sides. Once again, these very basic numbers. And it's also some fascinating things in the inside of how they relate one to another and are parallel one to another, how the golden rectangle it works out, especially in the dodecahedron, and the symbolic elements of those things. Well, that's a whole other discussion. But you see then how those numbers and how those other things can then connect together. So you've seen some aspects of the visual, but as architect Alberti said, we shall therefore borrow all our rules for the finishing of proportions from the musicians who are the greatest masters of this sort of numbers, and from those things wherein nature shows herself most excellent and complete. Another commentator said, art is an experience of balance, of the relationship of its parts to the whole. Perceiving it as anything else is missing its most fundamental component, a fine painting, a piece of sculpture, a work of architecture, music, prose, or poetry is organized and gracefully balanced around a hidden sense of proportion. And as Albert Dürer said, geometry is the right foundation of all painting. Number, then, becomes the foundation of how we see what is the correct proportion, what is pleasing to the eye, and the interrelatedness of all these things. Now, the fun thing is that those proportions, those numbers that we talked about earlier with Pythagoras as being the most harmonious, those relationships and those ratios are the same things which are most pleasing to the eye with regards to painting, with regards to architecture, etc. That's one of the things, one of the reasons why Goethe said that that architecture is frozen music. That those things which are pleasing to the ear are also pleasing to the eye, and for the same reasons. And I had a quote years ago, and I haven't been able to find it again, but it was an engineer saying basically the way in which the wing of an airplane has to be created in order for it to work aerodynamically and to actually, you know, cause the plane to lift are the same things which cause it to be beautiful. You know, there's a type of curve, there's a type of linear aspect of the construction of a wing that's very pleasing to the eye. And it's not just there for aesthetic purposes. Hope not. You know, hope it's functional. But the things that make it functional as required by the laws of nature, which God created, are also those things which make it beautiful. And those things are then consistent from the oral and the visual. The beauty of music, as James Gaines says, of course, is what sets it apart from virtually every other human endeavor, is that it does not need the language of ideas. It requires no explanation and offers none, as much as it may say. The practice of music, the oral aspect, is probably where most of our instruction occurs. We're not probably generally bringing in Platonic solids to talk about music. Although if you are, that's awesome. I think that's great. But it's where most of our instruction occurs. But understanding the foundation, the interconnectedness of what this means then in the other spheres. I taught geometry for 2 years at New College specifically so that I can understand music better. I wanted to be in the classroom to work my way through Euclid, which is a wonderful experience, by the way. Wow, that sounded really geeky. Sorry, but who am I? Look at who I'm talking to. You get that? Okay, good. But to walk through that and the understanding of what he's doing bit by bit, logically in proportions, is a beautiful thing. And if you've not looked at Euclid, the Pythagorean theorem is proposition number 47 out of 48 in book one. It's one of the most basic things we learn, right? You know, you have three triangles. You have a triangle with the sides of 3, 4, and 5, and the two shorter sides squared equal the longer side, right? You know, 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. Euclid doesn't really matter so much about numbers. He's looking at the relationships. What he's interested in is, and of course, as you know, the square, a number squared is the formula for the area of a square. What he's looking at is what are three types of squares such that the relationship of those three squares happen to form a certain type of triangle, and being able to prove that. So it's not about throwing numbers into a formula. It's about understanding the relationship and the ratio between different shapes, different sized lines, etc. It's a fascinating aspect of that. One of the other things about that, too, it's like, why didn't I learn this somewhere along the line? I could have left that. That's a triangle number. Why? Because it forms a triangle. Yeah. Six is also a triangle number. As compared to a square number. The next square number is then, of course, 9. 3 times 3 squared equals 9. Because it's a square That's so cool. It's like, nobody ever told me that. So you have triangular numbers, which we don't really talk about so much, but you have square numbers. And it's because, of course, the sides are the same. So, of course, the next thing would be 16, 4 by 4. 10 is the next triangular number, which we'll talk about a little bit in a minute. But those then have different inherent types of meaning. Certainly things that you don't get when if you write an Arabic numeral 9 or 16. So then what is the purpose of music? Why are we doing this? And you know, why am I talking about these esoteric things? Boethius talked about the idea there are three types of music: the music of the spheres, the music of man, and musica instrumentalis, or the actual practice of music. And this was a controlling idea of music and music education for hundreds of years, if not thousands. There were these different types of music and how then they related. From the philosophy point of view, and the theological point of view, music of the spheres was the most important in their thinking because that helped us understand more the created order and how God had made things and how things held together. We'll talk a little bit about musica humana in a minute, music of man. I think we understand more about the practice of music with instrumentalis. I want to concentrate briefly on the idea of a musical counterpoint as an example of how this connects to the music of the spheres. It's hard to, this quote from John Roon, it is hard to write a beautiful song. It is harder to write several individually beautiful songs that when sung simultaneously sound as a more beautiful polyphonic whole. The internal structures that create each of the voices separately must contribute to the emergent structure of the polyphony, which in turn must reinforce and comment on the structures of the individual voices. The way that it is accomplished in detail is counterpoint. So the reflected order, the created order, the intentionality and orderliness inherent in the creative cosmos was a discipline then for study of musicians and for emulation. Music of the spheres was a controlling concept, as I mentioned. The order of the cosmos was analogous to the inner structure of music in its ratios and relationships as well in its harmony. Giuseppe Zarlino wrote in his book on harmony in 1558, "Every reason persuades us to believe that the world is composed with harmony, both because its soul is a harmony, as Plato believed, and because the heavens are turned around their intelligences with harmony, as may be gathered from their revolutions, which are proportionate to each other in velocity. This harmony is known also from the distances of the celestial spheres, for these distances, as some believe, are related in harmonic proportion, which, although not measured by the sense, is measured by the reason." So this idea is that the music, any body in movement makes a sound. And so, obviously, the heavenly bodies were creating some sort of sound, and it would just make sense that if they're creating a sound, the sound that they're making together is harmonious, because God would not have created a discordant world. Those things creating. So then came the whole issue of, well, if they're making music, why can't we hear it? So there were several explanations of that. One was that we hear it all the time, it says that we don't hear it anymore. And so it's there, but just kind of, it's not, we don't necessarily hear it. And if it were to stop, we would recognize the absence of it immediately. The other thing is that it's so low that it's beyond our hearing capacity to hear. And so it's not something that we are able to hear ourselves. Interestingly enough, in recent science, we have discovered that, you know, planets do make noise. And the sun sends out solar flares that are much like guitar strings that make various frequency sounds. So it's interesting, interesting connecting point there. It's a low, deep, grumbling noise. It's really low below our. I'm not sure actually. That's a good point. Yeah. There's a way to the lights. There's a way to kind of tune a room too. Our music professor goes around our building sometimes with the students and listens to the aspects of the building to see if they are all harmonious together. Because it's amazing. If you've ever used noise reduction headphones without any music coming through, but just kind of to do the canceling noise, it's amazing how quiet it is. All the noise, you hear it now, the air conditioning, background, all the noise we just absorb and we don't even think about. If that can be harmonious or discordant as well, you can create various levels of stress or not. In fact, one of the things that, in at least in one study, one of the aspects of flying long flights that causes the most fatigue is the noise of the engines of the airplane. That constant roar that you almost don't even notice. It's your brain is having to process that sound the whole time, and it wears you out. Which is one reason why people, especially who travel a lot, either listen to music or noise reduction headphones, etc., to cancel that out so that they have something more ordering to their mind instead of that aspect of the of travel. Scholars, philosophers, theologians, Pythagoras, Plato, Aristotle, Confucius, Augustine, Boethius, Cassiodorus, Ptolemy, Kepler, Luther, Newton, have I made my point, started from this perspective of the universe that was harmonious. For Augustine, Boethius, Ptolemy, and Kepler, this also led to the writing of books on music. Luther wrote, "You will find that from the beginning of the world, music has been instilled and implanted in all creatures, individually and collectively, for nothing is without sound or harmony. Music is a gift and largesse of God, not a human gift. Praise through word and music is a sermon in sound." And as Kepler said, "The movements of the heavens are nothing except an everlasting polyphony perceived by the intellect, not by the ear." As he continues to, as Jamie James points out in his book, Evening in the Palace of Reason, the concepts of the musical universe and the great chain of being originate in the classical bedrock of our culture, flow through the Christian tradition, and remain firmly centered in the Renaissance and the Age of Reason. They are at the core of the culture. It was not until the 19th century that the perspective shifted decisively to the earthly, the tangible. Materialism and sensuality, qualities that had been deeply mistrusted throughout most of the Western tradition, emerged ascendant. And it was also this change in thinking that brought about the demise of counterpoint and of polyphony. The idea and ethos of counterpoint that permeated the musical world cannot be understated. David Yearsley wrote a book called Bach and the Meanings of Counterpoint. And he gives a picture of this. He says, in the first half of the 18th century, no set of musical practices was richer in significance than strict counterpoint. Indeed, the minute, exacting, and seemingly esoteric world of canon could match the hermeneutic resonance of the most opulent of operas. No musical endeavor generated more polemical writing and more heated opinions during Bach's lifetime than did strict counterpoint. No set of techniques inspired greater devotion from its practitioners or more spirited antipathy from its detractors. Musicians literally wrestled over coveted books of contrapuntal knowledge. Some guarded troves of contrapuntal treasure with almost mythic fervor. Others consigned the long traditions of contrapuntal training to useless history. If you know anything about the life of Bach, you probably know the story of when he was young, as an orphan, he was living with his brother. And the story goes that at night, because his brother would not give him access to some music, he would go down at night by moonlight and reach his hand through the grill of a hutch or something and pull out the music and copy it in secret so that his brother wouldn't know. And apparently had the his brother's wife was complicit in this because he would play the pieces when his brother was not at home. One day his brother came home unexpectedly while he was in the middle of playing and discovered that Bach had basically stolen this music by making copies of it, and according to which version, either took it and tore it up or took it away from him. Some sources suggest that he got it back then later in life. I think the story is not apocryphal. I think it's true, but it's... it's an interesting anecdote in Bach's life, and it kind of reads somewhat of what a mean brother he had and how advanced he was because his brother wouldn't allow him to play some of this music, but he was able to play it anyway, and he showed his brother. And it's kind of hard to know what to deal with that story. Unless you put it more into the context that the secrets of counterpoint and of more involved music was one that one was initiated into, that it was a slow process, that it was deep knowledge that needed to be passed along in a way in which a teacher would do so with their pupil. The mentor would do that over a period of time to make sure that they could fully understand and comprehend and utilize. Because if you're viewing counterpoint or music as something which is structuring and ordering not only your mind, but the aspects of the universe, it's not something that you trifle with. It's not like throwing a piece of music in front of a young pianist and say, let's play the notes. It's something you have to kind of earn the right to be able to do. And so put into that context that his brother was actually not being mean and withholding these things, but were saving those things for a time in which he could more fully understand and comprehend, although I think Bach probably could have. But it was put in that context, the story makes a whole lot more sense. This was important knowledge as viewed that was not just handed out freely. It's not like downloading a song on your iPhone or your Walkman, that dates me, in which you could just listen to at any point in time. And it was not an individualistic exercise. It was a communal thing, and it had much greater import there. Then music, especially counterpoint, was an indicator of the divinely created order. James Gaines also writes and says, the cosmological harmony was actually one of the few ideas in which philosophers, scientists, and theologians of Bach's time were agreed. Newton, for example, could not imagine that a world so orderly as this one could have occurred by natural cause alone. A powerful, ever-living agent governs all things, he concluded, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all. He continues by quoting Luther, who says, we marvel when we hear music in which one voice sings a simple melody, while three, four, five other voices play and trip lustily around, reminding us of a heavenly dance. Usually states also, the constant motion of the heavens is thus analogous to the perpetual revolution of the parts in a well-constructed piece of double counterpoint, whose inversions mirror the perfection of heaven and provide earthly things with a glimpse of God's unending order, a prelude to the heavenly concert. The idea, too, you need to realize that the earth as the center with the seven spheres around, which included the known planets and the moon and the sun. The seven, those orbits then were recognized as the seven tones of the scale. And so the idea of the relationship then between those orbits and those proportions between those revolutions were such that they then were construed to form a harmonious whole. Kepler was able to make this, Copernicus was able to make this work out by taking the Platonic solids and actually putting them one into another. As the sense of spheres. Now, we look at that and say, well, they didn't understand that we all revolved around the sun. Now, you know, there's a difference between facts and truth. And from the theological perspective, how they were viewing the world and the universe is that as creating God's image, men and women, Earth, was the center of creation, and all the planets and moon and sun and stars were created in service then to the central part of creation. And so from this philosophical, theological perspective, it makes perfect sense. Of course, as sun in service to the earth, then the connecting point would be the center of the earth with the sun revolving around. So there's a lot to understand about why they thought that way, other than just they didn't get a full glimpse and understanding of astronomy and cosmology. And those things still work out. Harmonia, the idea then of music of man, the idea of harmony, of balance, of order and peace. If you know anything about, this comes up in Shakespeare a lot, the bodily humors, or at least in one Jane Austen movie version, you know, somebody's sick and so they bring out the leeches or they slice the arm because they have too much blood and you need to get the bodily humors back in order. That concept, that medical concept, is the idea of harmony. You need to get black bile and yellow bile and phlegm and blood in proper proportions to one another so that the body is healthy and works the way it's supposed to. Of course, that's ridiculous medicine, which is why we want to make sure that we eat the proper food groups and we have the right vitamins and supplements and so forth so that our body has all the things that it needs so that it works harmoniously together. It's the same concept, different practice, medically speaking. But the idea is that you have a complex mechanism that doesn't work right if parts are out of alignment. Things need to be harmonious one with the other. We retain some of this language. If your car is not running well, you take it into the shop for a tune-up. Your car needs to be retuned. The harmony needs to be restored to all those bits and pieces and parts inside your car. They're not operating the way that they should. They're not operating the way that they're supposed to. And so the harmony then needs to be brought to bear there. It's harmoniously working together, whether that's the state, whether that's the individual body, whether that's the heavens. There's a harmony then that makes things run well, and then it's also reflected of what is pleasing. So then, as an integrated discipline, listening, the idea of listening to numbers, we've seen some of this already. I'll keep you awake and use purple, different color here. I told you we'd talk about the next triangle number, the decad. Now, from what we've learned, we know that 10 is not just 10, but 10 is a mess. 10 is comprised of 1, 2, 3, and 4, right? We see how those are all then interrelated. Now, if you really want to get into symbolism, you can talk about 4 representing the earth, the 4 elements, the three principles of salt, quicksilver, and sulfur. Alchemy is a whole other discussion. Find me in the hall. We can have some fun with that one. 2 seeds, the sun and the moon, and 1 fruit, the world's soul. So you see the connecting then, the symbolic understanding then to the 10. You see also we move from 1 point, 2 points, 3 points, 4 points. And so within the concept of 10, which again is 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, we see 0 dimension, 1 dimension, 2 dimensions, 3 dimensions. So we have all that kind of connectedness as well. In terms of proportion and understanding, we've got 4 to 3, 3 to 2, 2 to 1, and 1 to 1. So, you know, ratio of 1 to 1, musically speaking, is an octave. 2 to 1, I'm sorry, is unison. 2 to 1 is an octave. Three to two is a fifth. Four to three is a fourth. Once again, the building blocks of Western musical understanding there, all in the context then of the relationship of 1 to 2, 3, and 4, then forming 10. Now, interestingly enough, also we've got the Platonic lambda. See, I'm messing up that spacing right there. Again. 1 on the top row, 2, 3, 4, 6, 9, 8, 12, 18, 27. Now, this is a fun little collection of numbers for a whole number of reasons. If you move in this direction, you see it doubles each way. And if you move in that direction, it increases by 3 times. 1 to 3, 3 to 9, 9 to 27, 2 to 6, to 18, etc. So you have interesting relationships there. Which also gives us, and this was important number important construction for Plato keying off of Pythagoras' ideas. You've got the 2 to 1 relationship. Anyway, you go that way, which represents the octave. Any of these then is a 3 to 2, which is the fifth. And if you go at an angle, you get the 4 to 3, which is the fourth. Now, hopefully you can see even from that simple visual representation that, you know, 1 to 1 is, you know, very simple. You don't have to do any movement. 2 to 1 works very consistently, very easily, in terms of an octave. You know, an octave, numerically speaking, is if you're talking about frequencies, it's just double or half. It's really easy. It's It's a really simple concept in terms of frequency and sound. You could technically divide an octave into any number of notes in between. And going back to our math here, you know, between any two points is another point. So you could make all sorts of microtones. We can't discern a lot of those, but you can make all sorts of microtones. How you divide an octave is different culturally. In Western practice, keying off of Pythagoras, with a 3-to-2 ratio, we come up with a fifth. The inversion is a fourth, also 4-to-3. And that's the backbone then of Western music. But you see, even here, this is pretty simple. The fourth gets a little more complex. And the more complex the ratio, the more complex the interval is. The tritone is a very complex ratio. It's not nearly as simple and as beautiful as what you see here with the most basic intervals. Now, one of the things that happens, and you probably know this from music classes here somewhere or another, with Pythagoras and the idea of the fifth, then comes the circle of fifths. You know, you start out on C, and you get a G, then you get a D, you get an A, E, B, F sharp, C sharp. Let's call it a D flat, A flat, E flat. So you get all the notes, and then if you then include all the octaves of those notes, then you have what we know as the 12 tones of music. Now, the difficulty is what's known as the Pythagorean comma. That doesn't quite work. It's out of tune, which is one of the reasons, like with equal temperament, we make everything slightly out of tune. Which I cannot help but believe that has some effect on how we perceive music, because anything that we hear is not granting the full resonance of overtones that you would have if it was perfectly in tune, because it's just slightly off. It's an interesting analogy to the way that we mark time. I think it's part of the fall. You know, you can talk about lunar months, 28 days. That's a great system, right? You know, the moon comes back around, but then it doesn't quite work. You can talk about a solar year, but then you have that fourth of a day that you have to do something with, and then you have to do something with that at a century mark, you know, or every 400 years. You've got an extra day in there. There are different ways to measure time, and they all make logical sense, rational sense, but then there's something about them that's just not quite right that you kind of have to kind of shove together. I think music works out the same way. I would propose that that's actually part of the fall, that it makes sense, but it doesn't quite work because of the fallen nature of the world. So I think we have celestial perfect music to enjoy at some point in time, but that's an aspect of that just doesn't quite fit together. Pythagorean tradition, astronomy is interpreted as magnitudes in motion, geometry as magnitudes at rest, arithmetic as numbers absolute, and music as numbers applied. So you have those various aspects as well. We've talked about harmonia and the correct relationship there. Hearing cosmology, what does this sound like then? Douglas Adams, the great philosopher and novelist, wrote that Beethoven tells you what it's like to be Beethoven, and Mozart tells you what it's like to be human. Bach tells you what it's like to be the universe. There's another quote I didn't include. I'm going to butcher. I always butcher quotes. That's why I write them down. But I'm going to do it anyway. It says basically, if you want to stop any discussion at a party, just mention the fact that Bach is a much superior composer to Mozart. And here people kind of stop. But, you know, there it is. There's so much more, substance there because of what he's doing. James Gaines, again, from Evening in the Palace of Reason, expresses the power of music succinctly and beautifully when he says, "The beauty of music, of course, what sets it apart from virtually every other human endeavor, is that it does not need the language of ideas. It requires no explanation and offers none, as much as it may say. Perhaps that is why music coming from a world where the invisible was palpable, where great cosmic forces played their part everywhere and every day, could so deeply move audiences so far from Bach's time. Whether in the thrilling exuberance of the polyphonic credo, or in the single voice of an unaccompanied cello, in works extravagantly expressive and as intimate as a whisper, Bach's music makes no argument that the world is more than a ticking clock, yet leaves no doubt of it. There is a created order that lends structure and ratio and relationship then to harmonious music. There's an objective standard about what music, how music can be measured. One of the things that Bach did, his sons would talk about this, is that he could hear the inherent potential of a musical idea and then be frustrated if it wasn't fulfilled. Part of his criteria then of good music was that it fulfilled all the potential that those particular arrangements of notes held. And that's a whole different criteria of how we would think about music, but that's how he thought. That's how his mind worked and how he perceived the importance of what music was doing. Excellent music doesn't just happen, as we all know. It's a result of study, work, craftsmanship, and practice. Zarlino, in his harmony book from the 1500s, says, "A composer should not be satisfied with mastering his craft, but should know the reason for what he does. To sing and play skillfully to God's glory requires knowledge and wisdom. Just as it was necessary for God to train the people of Israel to know how to worship, the church needs to continually train itself in the aspects of worship by God's standards. Part of this training is an understanding of why and how certain music works and whether it's appropriate then for corporate worship." There's this relationship between number and music. Those that are most pleasing, the ratios, how they sound. Going back to Ephesians 3 for a moment, "So that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God." There's a proportion structure. The love of Christ is that which surpasses knowledge. Grounded in love, rooted and grounded in love. Paul's writing with a desire that we would have the strength to comprehend and to be filled with all the fullness of God. In there, he also talks about length. Two dimensions. Height and depth. But he also adds breadth. And there we enter the fourth dimension. It's part of the beauty of what music holds, and how we teach it, and the reasons why. Why we select what we do, how we entertain it in the classroom, what we perceive as its role, how we engage our students, and why. For the beauty of understanding more of the nature and the mind and the character of God, and to intersect even more so with the works of creation, the mighty works of his decrees worked out in the works of creation. Any questions? None? Great.
It's all clear now.
Yeah, great. Very good. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And its changes, but always in relationship to the originating note, so to speak, or the frequency. So, like for instance, speaking about music of the spheres, as the sound of those spheres, if you will, moves, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be in tune with a particular point in the earth here. So it's not just. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes.
The point of observation.
Yes.
Optimal.
Yes. Was that a question or a very astute observation?
No,
that was great.
I just want to hear a little more from you. You sparked that thought while you were talking.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, in terms of the vantage point of hearing, and with regards to then how God created in the universe in service to, and if you do any research into issues of cosmography or astronomy, you recognize quickly that the Earth could not exist as a habitable planet if the other planets were not there. It's not just that there's these nice spheres going around the sun, but they all serve a purpose to make Earth what Earth is, to make it habitable, to help it retain its orbit, the magnetic fields to catch the blast of the asteroids that are moving through the solar system so that they don't reach Earth. All these planets absorb various
Yeah.
Right. They all serve a purpose which then makes Earth the center of where God has created and placed his created image. And so, yes, the vantage point aspect of that. Now, there's, you know, as I said before, there's a bit of a difference between fact and truth. I love the beauty of some of these ideas. They don't always necessarily pan out. I mentioned alchemy quickly earlier. It's a fascinating concept in terms of understanding the desire to be more like Adam in terms of control of nature. You know, the whole idea of alchemy is not making gold, but becoming the type of person in holiness that one could then have dominion over nature in such a way that one could do that. But of course, if one were that way, one really wouldn't desire the gold. So it's not about getting rich. You know, it's a whole different process. It's interesting. Some in the room may not agree with me on this one. But one of the things that Bede does, I think, in the ecclesiastical history is that as he talks about the various saints, he tells miracles about their dominion over the various elements. So you have Aidan overcoming fire or water, and that he has, because of his holiness, because of his sanctification, he has become more like Adam and then has the dominion over creation in those particular ways. So that's that created the aspect of the created order, the center of what God has created, and the beauty of those ideas, you know, being able to actually measure what the sounds of the spheres are like, gets a little sketchy. There have been attempts. You know, there's one composer who took the frequencies of the planets and then elevated them to aural range, and so that we can actually hear. And then tried to compose in that vein. I always find those attempts to not quite be. It's like making whale songs or something. It's interesting, but it's not really conducive. Now, there's an interesting study also with regards to bird song, in terms of how our understanding of ratio and proportion is consistent with what we hear in nature with regards to things like bird song. So, in fact, various folks have actually charted out, written. In notes, what birdsong sounds like. Tim?
I'm not sure exactly how to ask this, but we talk about consonants and beauty, mm-hmm. tones and numbers. Right? Mm-hmm. Has anybody done any numbers analysis work on particular melodies, simple melodies at least, that are very, very beautiful? It seems like it would be very, very complex.
Yes, and I think that's the you know, the consonances are the essentially the places of rest. So that doesn't negate the need for dissonances, of course. You know, and so but understanding then the relationship of how one moves through those into those places of rest and those places that make more sense. I mean, that's like, you know, you in your own lives, you appreciate those times of peace and harmony all the more so because of the times that were not that way. You know, if you were happy all the time and content all the time, well, we're called to be content, but forget that one. If you were happy all the time, then you wouldn't necessarily know it. But it's understanding how God works through difficult circumstances that shows, you know, his strength and your weakness, that you appreciate the time. Music works the same way. You know, you move through dissonances, you move through those things, but then you arrive somewhere. It's also part of that structuring and ordering of time. So those, you know, interestingly, in some ways, that's kind of what Shankar was doing in his analysis. You know, Shankar would take... had a whole class of Shankarian analysis. It was the professor and me. That was it. Everyone else dropped out, but he still taught me anyway. He would ask the class questions. It was me. But basically, you know, this is a little bit controversial, but what Shankar was doing was he would take an entire piece of music, whether it was a page long or a movement of a symphony or entire symphony, and show how it could be broken down to major points, which were basically either a descending 3-2-1 or 5-4-3-2-1. And with basic, you know, if it was 3-2-1, it was basically a harmonic progression of 1-5-1. And so he would take, you know, 14 minutes of music and reduce it to these are the major consonant pillars of this piece. And all these other notes are then in service to how those moments are created. Fascinating. I'm not sure how, you know, it's... You always run into the discussion of what's the difference between the creative act and then the analysis of it. That can be rather paralyzing if one goes into composing or writing or painting with I need to kind of fulfill these things. It's that retrospect of being able to look back and seeing, oh, this works the way that it does. It's harmonious visually or orally because it does then adhere to these types of ideas. Mm. I know we need to move along, but if you have any other questions, please come up or find me later. Thank you for coming. I appreciate it.